It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 461 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. It's yet another busy week here at the podcast, so episode 461 has three great guests that you'll enjoy listening to. First up is Todd Black from Tokyo Blade Detectives, and he's got a Kickstarter going on for the fourth issue in the series. It's described this way. Miko and Michio have to come to terms with the realization of a gun in Tokyo and seek solace in their own ways. This project will conclude at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Monday, December 7, so be sure to support them as soon as you can. Next is a brief reminder from Frank Gogol, who talks about his excellent Source Point Press comic Dead End Kids, The Suburban Job, that you can pre-order now. Don't miss what he has to say. Then everything wraps up with the return of Travis Gibb, who always has powerful stories to tell. He's got a Kickstarter going on right now for Cthulhu Invades Oz that's described as Lovecraft meets Oz in this amazing anthology. Be sure to support this excellent comic before the project ends on Tuesday, November 24, just a few days away, at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Don't delay. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's always great to talk with Todd Black, one of the major creative forces behind a series called Tokyo Blade Detectives. And issue number 4 is being supported right now on Kickstarter. And Todd, looks like you're doing pretty well, actually, at this point. How you doing?
Hey, Wayne. I'm doing good. Glad to be back. The Kickstarter's doing pretty well. We are in week 2 right now. Got 67 backers at the time of this recording, and almost $1,200, and I'm thrilled about it.
That's great, because that's surpassing your goal, which I thought was extremely reasonable, of $750. Yeah. So now let one people get on me, because I never give this information soon enough for them. It concludes on Monday, December 7 at 6 p.m. Eastern Time.
Yeah.
But don't wait until then.
No.
You know what? Todd's not going to have the daily heart attack at this point, because unless somebody pulls a $500 pledge back or something. But right now he's in good shape, but this is not a good place to make him sweat a little bit at all. Just he's going to get in stretch goals going or really good. And I would say let's support now and let's not wait. There's always a little rush right towards the end that people do.
Yeah, people always say that, and then like sometimes I don't get it, and I'm like, "Why do they say that, Wayne? Like, why do they say that?"
Well, I've seen it. I mean, some people actually do like little video presentations as it comes to the end, and they sit there and talk about all this stuff, and you can sit there and watch people kind of at the last second kind of pour in and pour in and pour in. But unfortunately, not everybody gets that apparently. So we don't want to raise false expectations that somehow you're going to get a big rush at the end, so they don't have to do anything. Don't do that. Do it now as quickly as you can, and get it going up there, because the money will come out right around December 7 at 6 p.m. on that Monday. But plan for that. There's some people don't plan for it and they're surprised when money tries to come out of their account and they're cutting it close. So we don't want to have that happen
either. Yeah, I've had that happen before.
So we don't want to do that. So anyway, why don't we start off, Todd, by giving people, if they haven't heard you before and they aren't familiar with your book, tell people what Tokyo Blade Detectives is about.
All right. Tokyo Blade Detectives is what I like to call an anime-style comic. It's set about 200 years in the future. And Japan has just been ravaged. They were in a world war. They were in a civil war. They had a complete reconstruction of the country. And in the process, they decided that they needed to do something big to try and deter the violence and stop them from being decimated again. So using their epic technology, they rebuilt their country, but they made one rule that absolutely no one can break. You cannot have a gun. And so this created a power vacuum. And so using their incredible technology, they started to make laser swords. Yes, Laser swords. I can't say the other word, so it's laser swords. And this gave the rise up to five factions, each vying for power in Tokyo and Japan in general. And then, of course, there's the emperor who has his loyal samurai trying to keep the peace. And it's basically just a war zone, especially in Tokyo, where all the factions are based. And for the people who live there, they're just trying to get by day to day, which is really hard when you have all these factions fighting for turf and territory. And our main character, Miko, is a 16-year-old girl who is a detective just trying to get by. And she's thrust into this large series of events that are going to change her life and change Tokyo and Japan forever.
Hmm. And what's the name of her mentor?
Michio.
Michio. I always am afraid it's Miko and Mikio, and I'm always like, is that the way you pronounce it? Because not every comic comes with a pronunciation guide, and I'm always worried.
Yeah, I know, right? It's like, how do you say Mjolnir? It took me forever to learn that one.
Or Bilsinkevich.
There you go.
I for years thought it was Sinkiewicz or something, and then I saw his booth at New York Comic Con, and made me laugh. And a great big banner above the booth, it said SIN-Kev in big letters.
I think that's why a lot of anime, or I think that's why a lot of comic book protagonists have very easy to say names.
Yeah.
You know, like Luke Cage and Steve Rogers, Tony Stark. You know. It's easy. It's easy to say those names. Bruce Wayne, all of that.
Yes. That's too true. If you get to comics from other countries, though, you start to see a little less of that, thankfully.
And, yeah.
You know, it's like Pokemon. I had a friend of mine I used to work with. He used to say that Pokemon were great because they taught kids to speak a language of their own, you know, all these different things that had different names. And he had a son that loved it. And he felt he was learning how to speak Japanese or something as a result of what I saw. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I mean,
gets him
used to other words. I mean, that's a good thing. So that's good. So as you and I have talked in the past, you're a big anime fan, and it's cool that you can partake of this and get in there and actually tell stories in this genre. I think that's kind of fun. And I think the stories have been really entertaining. And I love a good action story where things are moving a lot of the time. I like strong characters. Of course, I like a strong female lead, as people listen to this podcast know. And I think that you have developed a really great world. And that world building thing always gets me. I don't necessarily want to see New York City everywhere. And so when I get to see Tokyo, which is a very different place from where comics normally go, it's fun to see. And, you know, you and I have talked about the fact someday, somehow, we got to get you over to Tokyo so you can actually be in there. But hasn't happened yet, I don't imagine. And
I think 2020 kind of crapped on that. I mean, I'm just saying.
Well, maybe when we get past this, hopefully, in 2021, things will clear up, you can do that.
Yeah.
But I think that'd be fun for you, because I think it'll be, on some levels, it'll be educational. On some levels, it'll be disappointing. And other levels, it'll be uplifting. You know, it's the way these things go.
Well, so. It's just like, you know, I know what Tokyo looks like in general, because I've seen, obviously, shows and movies that honestly were set in Tokyo in one way or another. And of course, seen pictures. I know about, I could basically tell you where to go in Shibuya, because there was a video game that basically recreated that area, like point for point. So I pretty much know where to go there, more than likely. And, you know, there are certain things that I look up to make sure, you know, it's accurate to Tokyo, like Shibuya and the Scramble Crossing and all of them. But yeah, I'm sure there are going to be places where I'm like, oh yeah, this isn't how I pictured it. But I also tell myself, remember, I'm making this 200 years in the future. So there's going to be different things.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be different, which is good. But see, that world building thing, I love to see that. I don't necessarily like the same old story, but that the great thing is you're doing all these things in a very different setting and making it a very unique experience. And I really think that's one of the strengths, I think, of your books, is that it's fun. It's a chance for adventure. It's, you know, buckle that swash, daring do, with interesting and fascinating characters, I have to say. I just and the situation is, you're talking about the fact that there's no guns. And here you are dealing with the fact that suddenly one is, let's say, starting to appear. That's a really fascinating, in a culture without that involved, boy, that's a really big change. So that's just kind of interesting. Is and of course, I'm sure issue four will deal with a lot of that.
The big thing for me was that when I think I told you the story, but when I came up with the name for Tokyo Blade Detectives, it was totally random, and I had to think of a hook. Like, why is it Blade Detectives? Because if it's detectives, it's modern. You know, they didn't have detectives back in feudal Japan. So it's like, what would make it so they have to have blades? And I'm like, there's no guns. They refuse to use guns anymore. And I'm like, oh, that's perfect. And you might notice in issue three, I kind of tease what happens if you do get a gun, but you're literally not going to be ready for what happens when they decide to enact the punishment for it. It's violent. And that's a key thing, because I was like, you have to have a deterrent. You can't just say no guns allowed. Otherwise, America would probably have done that a century ago. But, you know, in Japan, especially in this technology field in Japan, there's got to be a deterrent, and we tease it constantly. And then when the time comes to do it, it's not going to disappoint. So for Miko, who's terrified of hearing that, you know, Toshiro had made a gun and she gave it to the Ronins, and now it's out there. She's like, I'm freaking out because I don't want this to happen, especially in front of me, which I noted in number three. So I can't wait to share that. But this is a big deal. This isn't just, oh yeah, of course a gun was going to show up. No, it's a gun showed up. This is going to be bad. So yeah, it's good stuff.
Do we know? I forget a little bit. It's been a little while since I read three. Sure. What kind of gun is this that we're talking about?
I defined it as a sniper rifle.
Okay.
I don't know why, but I've always had a fascination with sniper rifles, especially when I played Call of Duty. It's just, I really liked it. And for what is going to happen, I felt the sniper rifle was the most efficient way of doing it, because, you know, it's long range. You can build up to where you're going to shoot. You know, it's that kind of a thing.
We don't know what's coming. I mean, they can be a couple buildings away shooting.
Exactly.
But I understand. And so, you know, we kind of hope that we'll hear something. The gun will make a pow when you shoot it. You know, and I've actually fired a gun. I had a roommate who was into guns, and he slept with a rifle under his pillow. And he always said, don't make any noise at night, because if I get up and I'm thinking I'm in trouble, I'm going to start shooting. And I said, okay, believe me, I'll be quiet.
Yeah, I thought he wasn't my roommate.
He took me to a firing range, and we just did a pistol. And boy, did it have pow, and my hand would go back. And of course, he did that just so I would treat it with respect. And I said, I think I would have treated it with respect before that, but
oh, you'd be surprised.
Yeah. Well, I don't have a gun, and that's on purpose. I don't think I need it. If I need it, I think. Yeah.
I've always been a swords guy. I'm looking at my wall right now. I've got some Shaolin twin hooks on one wall. I've got the Master Sword on another from Legend of Zelda. I've got a small dagger from Ecuador that my mom got me. And I like blades a lot more. Swords are just a lot more pure in my mind, and that's why I was really happy to, you know, put all these swords into Tokyo and do really cool sword battles. And my artist Lam Vuvan, we're making number four right now. It's Kickstarter's going because we know we're going to get funded, and he just delivered a really cool sword fight between two characters, and you're gonna love it, I guarantee it.
It's gonna be fun. I am so see hand-to-hand combat to me is a lot more personal. To me, it's like we said, you shoot with a rifle like that. I mean, you are often nowhere near the person you're trying to hurt. And that is a very cold experience, I would say. You've got to, you know, it doesn't mean that you don't have a lot of bad feelings toward it, but that person, as we said, likely doesn't even know it's coming. Yeah. So it's going to be something wild. That is so wild. So this is going to be a really interesting development in a culture without any kind of gun. That's going to really be something special. Now, one of the things I noticed when I was listening to your video was that you talked about the fact that a lot of anime doesn't take, you know, a slow period or a downtime. It's one thing to the other, rush, rush, rush. And of course, we like action a lot, and visually, that's probably more interesting. But you're actually going to break that kind of thing. You're going to go a different route. Talk about that, because that's kind of interesting. That's something I haven't seen before, and I'm going to be really interested to see how you handle that.
Well, for me, watching anime and just cartoons in general, you could tell when an episode's going to be important, and then you could tell when an episode's going to be filler. Like, Pokemon's a great example of this, because when Ash is doing like a gym battle, a league battle, you know, fighting a rival, going after Pokemon he's trying to catch, you know that those are important episodes. And then like 80% of the other episodes are one-off adventures of, you know, hey, there's this new Pokemon, here's this new trainer, and you can pay attention to them, and they're fine more times than not, but it just doesn't feel meaningful. And then certain episodes don't even delve on big moments or experiences that happen. And Naruto is another one that's big on filler. Dragon Ball Z had whole filler arcs because the manga kept wasn't catching up to how fast the anime was going. And I'm just like, if I had a big moment like this, like we had number three with the reveal of the gun, and I've been teasing, you know, that this is a big thing, what would happen in the moments afterward? Because it would have been so easy just to do like a really quick one-off reference, or just do one page of, hey, the gun's out there, what are we going to do? Oh, we can't do anything, let's just move on. That wouldn't work in this context, because guns aren't supposed to be in Tokyo. Both Michio and Miko both have experiences with, you know, what happens when guns are around. And now they're like, what do we do? You know, do we tell people? Do we try and stop this? Do we go after the Ronin? We don't know. And this issue is, how do they deal with this major revelation? And I teased part of it in the 5-page preview that we have on the Kickstarter, in that Michio is going to talk to a contact of his, which we will see in the issue. And Miko is just going to try and go in distress, and we're going to meet a key character in her life when we get there. And then we're going to be teasing something else. And it's just like, I needed to show that this matters. And both Miko and Michio have very different reactions when they're in their little individual stories. And that was important to me, because for three issues, we've seen Miko as this very angsty teen, which, again, she's 16. And, you know, she's blunt to the bone. You know, she'll kill you. She doesn't care if you, as long as you, you know. But here in her story, we're going to see a different side of her. And then with Michio, we've seen him as kind of the wise old mentor. And then when he goes and meets his contact, that's something's going to change. And it's not going to be what you're expecting. And that was important to me, because the arc technically ended last issue with the reveal of the Ronin and that they have the gun. But with this, I see it as, you know, this is an epilogue because it ties off the story. It's an interlude because it tells its own stories. And then as I finished writing the script, I realized I can do more. So I wrote in like a prequel for the next arc. So there's a lot going on. There's basically four different stories in this issue, and that's really fun for me, because I like that kind of creative difference that I see in other comics and everything, both mainstream and indie. So yeah, there's a lot going on in this issue, and it makes me very excited to see it in full.
Gee, you're making me wonder. I want to ask a question, but I'm afraid I'll get the answer.
You can ask the question, just don't expect me to answer.
Okay, I mean, you're talking about the gun situation. Uh-huh. You're saying this is the end, the wrap up of the story. That storyline is going to wrap up.
No, I didn't say that.
Okay, see, that's what
I said that the arc ended. The arc ended last issue when they got the gun. You will not see the gun in this issue. What happens with that gun is coming, but not in this issue.
Interesting. Okay, so that's going to be the way you were talking, I thought you might be wrapping that whole storyline up. So that's good. So
that would be a rush, and I hate doing rushes. No, this. Okay, so what happens with the Ronin and the gun is a long-term story that's going to change things. If we build up to it with every arc, and this was just the capper. It's like, this is coming. It's coming, and you have to have it in the back of your mind. And every arc is meaningful because it's going to tie into the gun storyline, as well as other things are going on in Tokyo. And you're wondering, where does this lead? How does this connect? And then when it happens, you're going to see all the pieces coming into place, and you're going to be surprised by just how long-term storytelling I did. But in issue four, we're just addressing what happens now that the gun is here. So...
cool.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I've got to ask. See, now that we can be comfortable now, we know it's extremely likely that you're going to get your money and make the book and move forward. Are you going to do a second series after this? Are you gonna start with number five? Are you gonna call it a sub Tokyo, like Tokyo Blade Detectives colon The Gun or something? Number one.
It's an ongoing series. I'm dividing these up into volumes like a regular, you know, comic would. After number four, we're gonna take a small break because I need to go do some other projects, and I wanna shop this out to publishers. Okay. Because I really feel that this could be something that just works with publishers. But if they don't pick it up or whatever, then I'm going to just make it issue by issue on Kickstarter until I don't get funded anymore.
Okay. Are you thinking about Viz or that company or some other one?
I don't know. I have some options. I have a friend at a company who really likes this and thinks it'll work there. I'm going to shop it out to other publishers that I've pitched before. Like I might do Image, you know, I might pitch it to them because I know they might be interested. Mm-hmm. You know, they're always looking for new submissions, and I'll check out the big companies, check out the small companies, and I really feel that this is like one of the best series I've written. I'm not ashamed to say that I feel like I've written some good stories, but mm-hmm. this one I just feel is my kind of like a magnum opus of sorts, and where I am right now as a writer. So I want to see if a publisher can help me take it to the next level, and then we'll just go from there.
Cool. So it was really, I enjoy the art in particular. I love Miko's hair. Okay. How she gets it to stay like that, I don't know.
Technology.
Sure. It's hair technology. That's how it works. It's the future and how they do these things. Who
it's sci-fi, Wayne. Weirder things are happening.
Yeah, I just get a kick out of that. The big bluish hair that stands out. I hope she's okay getting through doorways and stuff like that.
I'm sure she manages.
Now, I'm sure we talked about a little of this before, but I think it might be good just to recap a little bit. Miko and Michio, are they based on – are they creations of your imagination? Well, they are. Okay, so they're not like based on anybody you know or
no. – I sadly only know a handful of people from Japan, like a guy I used to go to college with. But no, these are my interpretations of, you know, certain character tropes, like, you know, the angsty teen and the mentor. And then as I usually do, I shatter the expectations as you meet them. And they're fun. Now, I do have characters that are slightly based on other people, like the Empress, who's one of my favorite characters. She's based on a wrestler in WWE called Asuka, who calls herself the Empress of Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so I based her design off of Asuka, but then, of course, I just did a different personality, made her a killer queen, if you will. And a lot of the characters in the story are based off of, you know, either anime tropes or parts of Japanese folklore, like the yokai and the ronin and everything, samurai, obviously. I try to grab from as many references of sorts to Japan that I could, because it's just a rich culture. And, you know, between animes and, you know, actual live action films and just their own culture, there's so much to derive from. It's really fun. That's why I had a lot of fun making like the five factions, because each one is a representation of Japan in its own way.
So. Mm-hmm. Now, the Ronin's not a member of a faction, right?
The Ronin are a faction.
Well, they're their own faction. Oh, I forgot that. Okay.
Here, just for a rundown, the five factions are thus. There's the Empress and her cronies. There's the Tao, which is the religious cult. There are the Nine Tails, who you might see soon. There are the yokai, which are the terrorists, and then there's the ronin, who are the world breakers, if you will.
See, so, in the past, I've seen ronins. They've been kind of as rogue agents.
Yeah.
You know, that's interesting to see those.
Yeah, that's a good way of describing it, because their goal, as I note in the five-page preview, is they want to kill the emperor. They do not like the current emperor, who we have not met yet. And they want to put someone who was more in line with their master, who was the emperor's father. And they are willing to do whatever it takes to get that done, which is where the gun comes in. So,
gotcha. Okay, so that's something to look forward to. One of the things I enjoy about your book is the blending of Japanese culture and technology, which, you know, anime, that's been forever. They've been doing those kinds of fun things. But there's in the preview that you have on the Kickstarter page, I got a kick out of, there's like a box at the door. And, you know, Michio goes over and he presses the button. And out of the box, which is not a big box, comes this delivery guy. And he has a scroll. And he kind of bows down and he gives him the scroll. And then I guess he disappears again. Not even does he disappear, but the box disappears too. That's the future. That's technology right there.
That was so much fun to write. I was like, you got to have, if you're doing something in Japan, you got to have ninjas. And I was like, if I do a basic ninja, everyone's going to say, oh yeah, you just did a basic ninja. So I'm like, what's the most low key anti-ninja thing I could do? And I'm like, let's make them messengers. And I just thought of the idea of, like, you know, hey, there's a package for you. Do you want it? You press yes, the ninja shows up. And it's just like, boom. And I was like, that was perfect. And how Lom delivered it was awesome. And then Miko's line that I wrote of, I remember hearing about how ninjas were cool. We all have to evolve, Miko. Yeah, they went from killers to messenger boys. What an evolution. That was perfect.
Well, I like what the delivery guy says just as he's about to vanish. He says, thank you for supporting Ninja Delivery Service, delivering packages, parcels, and messages faster than you can say. And then he goes, poof.
Yeah. I have that my was moments. Great. I have my moments of good writing.
I thought that was great. I mean, I could see somebody in that circumstance wanting to say something like that. How he transports and stuff, that's something that's probably beyond something you even need to explain. It just happens to be that way.
I'm sure there's going to be somebody going, okay, is there like, are the ninjas are they just waiting? Are they waiting for the box to be pressed? Like, how does this work? Were they in the box? You said they were in the box. I never said he was in the box. It was like, are they in the box? Was the box just a messenger beacon? Was it a beacon to let them know where to teleport? I'm sure somebody's going to freak out and try to figure out the science to this. And I'm like, you do that. It's technology. That's all I have to say.
There was a wonderful time. I was seeing the guy who plays Riker on Next Generation. He was at a convention, and I was sitting there listening to him talking. Some kid gets up there about 10, 12 years old, says, you know, I don't understand the warp drive. He says, how can this do this way? Good, this go? And he breaks out into singing Volare at the top of his lungs, the guy who plays Riker does. And, you know, he waits until the kid finally gets discouraged. He realizes he's not going to get an answer. And then he moves to the next person. In other words, people are going to, you know, if you expect him to give a technical answer on how the warp drive goes, you're out of luck. It's a neck. So I found that real funny. That kind of reminds me of that people are out there. Cause I do run into a lot of people who don't, you know, some people want everything explained.
Yeah.
And I gratefully, you don't do that. You just let it go and let it happen. And our imaginations kind of work in how that could possibly be. And
that's part of the fun, because if you look at, have you ever watched a Full Metal Alchemist?
No.
Okay. Well, in the anime Full Metal Alchemist, the main character's name is Edward Elric, very anime name. And he has a metal arm, and this arm perfectly moves like a regular arm. He can flex, it can grab things. They don't explain how the arm works. Like, all you see is that it's connected to Elric's body, and they even show him losing the arm a couple of times just to show that, hey, this really is a prosthetic. And it's like, how does it move though? It's just metal. It's not robotics. They specifically state that it's not robotic, and yet it can flex, it can punch, he does clapping motions to unleash his magic and so on and so forth. But they don't explain that. You never have to wonder. It just works. And you can apply that to any anime. Even look at like Star Wars, where my laser swords come from, basically. The Mythbusters actually did an episode on Star Wars, two episodes actually, and they talked about lightsabers, and they go, this wouldn't work because plasma ain't finite when you charge it like that. It would be an endless beam of light or plasma. And so you couldn't shape it. So I literally can't explain how my laser swords work, because their very creation is impossible, because you wouldn't be able to actually shape it like a curved blade. It would be just a blob or a like a cylinder, or however you're able to focus the plasma. So I don't care about explaining that, because I don't need to, because even I don't know.
Well, the story would bog down if you spent a lot of time trying to explain it. I mean, we don't – it's there. I mean, you know, they accept it's real, and therefore we as the reader accept it's real. So we don't need to – you know, you're interested in telling a story. You're not interested in providing technical explanations for everything.
Yeah, and another great example of this is one of my favorite scenes in Tokyo that we've done so far, and that was in issue 2 when we went to the Tau. We had Miko go into the center of the Tau circle, and she basically does a prayer. And all of a sudden, the world just fades around her, and she's in like another dimension. Is she, though? Like, is she in a hologram, a warped sense of reality? Did she actually teleport out of the circle? We don't know, and it doesn't matter. It just matters that it looks cool. Okay. Sometimes you just got to go for what looks cool.
Well, yeah, and remember, comics are a visual medium. You know, I don't know why I have to tell people that sometimes. It just makes me laugh. You know, this is a visual thing. You're seeing things. It's not like you have to explain all with lots and lots of words. You know, the visuals are the important thing. And so for the story you're telling, it's entertaining to me. I was very entertained when I saw the box. I had to say that made me smile. That whole sequence does. But the thing is that's a small diversion, but it's and a level, another level, you're providing us some idea that we don't know everything that could go on.
Yeah.
And I like that. Yeah. I like not knowing.
Yeah. Like, and that was another thing I wanted to do with the five factions, is that every one of them has their own style and, you know, system. With the Empress, I like to refer to her as the gang, because she's the leader. Everyone else is peons, basically. You know, they have very basic laser swords. And they go and do about their thing. Then you have, you know, the Tau, who like to paint themselves as magicians and use technology to, you know, weave reality in and around them. Then you have the Yokai, who are, again, the terrorists. And they, as we showed in number 3, are able to create these smoke projections that allow them to fly. And that's really cool. Then you got the Ronin, and then the Ninetales, who we're going to be seeing soon. And they have their own special abilities. And that's just how it works, is that everyone has the technology more or less available to them, and how they use it is up to them, which we showed also in number 3 with Miko, because you looked at her outfit, you didn't see anything weird with that, and then all of a sudden she has butterfly wings. Mm-hmm. So, which is another thing I was really happy to see come out finally. But that thing, you didn't expect that going in there. You just thought, oh, she's wearing a really unique anime style outfit. No, it can transform into butterfly wings and help her fly. So, awesome.
Well, that's the thing. I there are some storytelling. Now, on the other hand, magic drives me crazy when people pull a rabbit out of their hat. You know, suddenly you're in this, you're painted into a corner, shall we say, and you have no way out, and then suddenly say, oh, it's the good thing I have the magic Kabila button or something, and I can just press this button and then it'll solve all this stuff, which we've never seen before and we'll never see again. And I'm always kind of like, oh man, that's disappointing.
Yeah, I've had that with stories. Like the magic is so strong that they paint themselves into a corner, and then they do the most benign or stupid thing ever to get out of it. And it's just like, you built it up for that? Like, yeah. Ugh.
Well, see, you don't do that, thankfully.
Not,
I mean, you
yet,
do
the. Yeah,
well, see, but like minor things like the technology of the box and stuff like that. I mean, we don't need to necessarily, you know. I it's a fun diversion, is what it is. It's but when we get to major things going on, you have set the stage properly, and like one of the things I'm just fascinated though, you when you're on the Kickstarter page, you're talking about the facts that we've gotten glimpses into the pasts of Miko and Michio, but this time we're going to dive deeper. And to me, one of the things I struggle with anime is the fact that I don't often get to like the characters. Some people are going to shoot me for saying that, but okay. I don't. That it's not deep enough for me, but the fact that you're going to explore these two characters and maybe take them out of away from each other for a moment, so we get to see how they function on their own, I think that's going to be a really, really interesting thing. I'm really fascinated to see that.
for me, characters are why I love to write. Like, it started with fan fiction, then it became, you know, teleplays for Shazam TV series that I still want to make. And then it became comics and then novels and everything else. I love writing fun characters. And all my comics, no matter what they are, I believe that they have strong characters, especially in the leads. But with Tokyo, I'm trying to even top that, because I want to make it feel that every character you meet, from the factions to Miko Michio to the Emperor when we eventually meet him, to everyone else, that they have a role to play and that it's all going to intertwine. And I learned about it, but I saw this beautifully exemplified, ironically, in Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood. And because every character you meet from basically episode one to the very end, they all are connected and they have this depth to them that just weaves the story in and out. And even when Edward isn't there, which is like for like five or six episodes at one point, because he's injured, like they carry the story. And you're curious about, like, you know, what Roy Mustang is doing and Hawkeye and, you know, Alphonse and all of them. And I loved that. And that was really engaging to me. So for Tokyo, I'm going for that very much wide net. Like, we're going to see more of the Empress and her connection with Miko, because they've got a deep history, as we teased in number two. You know, the Tao will be coming back. The Ninetales are going to have a very interesting thing. We're going to meet another character during the second arc that also ties into Miko and kind of terrifies a lot of people when they show up, and on and on. And I've got more ideas of more, you know, intertwining threads and characters. And it's so fun to me, because I like writing both deep characters and deep storylines that have a meaningful payoff, and it gets you excited. And this is why I love writing, is that I can think that far ahead and go, oh yeah, this is how this is going to connect to that, and this is when this character shows up, and this will change everything. It's going to be fun, and it's I love it. I love it so much.
Well, that's an important thing. As I often say on this podcast, it's a certain company that does this huge event, and it sort of fizzles down, and then we get to the end of that event, another big event comes along, and none of them ever satisfy me with the way that they conclude. So I have basically shunned all those events at this point. But to me, I want something, a meaningful twist or turn that lets me know things are going to be different from this point on. So I'm looking forward to this issue, because I think we're going to really, really get to look at stuff from new angles and get to understand the characters better. And that, to me, I mean, I'd like, as I've said, more anime to do that. I'm always interested that characters in anime tend to get more and more and more powerful, is what they're going. I think that kind of replaces character development to me.
Goku. And
I mean, he's the super Goku, and then he's super hyper Goku, and then he's, you know, the ultra hyper super Goku. And I'm going like, okay.
How many hair colors do you have, Goku? How many, Goku? It's like, and noting that, I was doing a work script the other day, I write for YouTube, and one of them was the most impactful entrances in anime history. And the one I wrote about for Dragon Ball was the arrival of Super Saiyan Goku. Because when that happened, when we got the first Super Saiyan transformation against Frieza on Namek, it was powerful. Krillin just died. Goku was enraged. Frieza was taunting him, and you wanted him to die, Frieza, to die, but you didn't know if Goku could do it. All of a sudden, he busts out Super Saiyan Goku, and you're like, oh, here we go. And that meant everything. And then, with 3 came out, and 4, and then Super Saiyan God, Super Saiyan God, Super Saiyan, now Ultra Instinct, it loses the impact, because it's like, it doesn't mean as much. It's just, oh, it's the next level. Oh, okay. Whereas Super Saiyan, the original Super Saiyan, was, this means something. This is the next tier to let Goku fight the bad guys. And even though Dragon Ball has had its moments, especially in Super, a lot of people know that, you know, they have to hinder Goku some way, somehow. Otherwise, he's just all powerful. And that's not good storytelling.
And not only that, it's the same guy. I mean, there's no character movement at all. It's all he is bigger and brighter hair and all that kind of stuff. And see, that doesn't appeal to me. And this is why I think your story appeals to me so much, is because these are realistic characters. And granted, the circumstances are a little different, but that's good, because we get to learn stuff about them from the circumstances that they're in. So I think it's really, really looking forward to this issue. According to Kickstarter, the delivery of some of the stuff's going to begin in February of 2021.
I put that as a tentative. I'm just going to say that right now. I put that as a tentative because with the last one, number three, we thought we would get it done sooner, and then we had a delay in the art. We had a delay in lettering. And then by the time I was shipping out, it was like October 1st, which is when I was telling people that we'd make it to. And so I wanted just to give myself the biggest buffer because the holiday season's coming out. The post office is not doing good by Kickstarter people like me. Mm-hmm. And like I had a person tell me like a month after I sent the stuff out that he just got it. And I'm like, how did it take that long? You're only a few states away. So it's likely going to be coming a lot sooner than that, but I'm just hedging my bets to let people know that it will be coming.
It's like Scotty in Star Trek. He says, you know, you've got to give these things, and otherwise, how do you get your reputation as a miracle worker if you don't set up stuff like that? And so that's how this works. I wanted to talk about the All Gone part of the Kickstarter. I'm always fascinated, and I actually got this done. I was the part that you had 10 backers who took the right of being drawn into Tokyo.
Yeah.
And that you had to pledge $50 or more to do it. That reward is no longer available. I actually, there was one, it was a Moby Dick, and I always forget the last part of it, is I actually, it was $80, and I actually said, okay, I got some money, I'm going to get into a comic. And I actually took one of those levels, and I asked the writer when I was talking with him, can you show me where it was? I haven't noticed it. And then when he pointed it out to me, and I went, oh, all right. I said, I made a big picture of that. I'm going to keep that. So this business of being drawn into comics, and you got 10 people.
Yeah, that was a first for Tokyo. Like, we had gotten close to selling out, but we never made it. And then this time around, some people decided to up their pledge and to get drawn in. And I was like, awesome. And I love that. On the Moby Dick story, it wouldn't happen to have been a zombie Moby Dick, would it?
Yes, it would. Yes, it would. That was the one I got drawn into.
That's my friend Matt Shore. He's
So that's I always get mad because I always forget the it's Moby Dick and I forget the rest of it. Ah, brain not working all the time. But all right. I got drawn into it and I was so happy with it. Now that I've got it, I have saved that picture forever so I can say, "See, comic. See, I'm in the comic this time." So I mean. You guys are already deep in creating the book. I mean, how are you going to get these 10 people in? Is it going to be like a crowd scene where you're going to do it, or how are you going to do it?
Oh, yeah. What we did is what I usually do is when I write the script and I know I'm going to be putting in people, I'll make sure I have a scene where we can feature them. Now, number three was tough because I literally, because of the context of the story with the yokai chase and everything, I knew it had to be like one page. And so I only had like two panels where we stuffed in like nine people outside of one, cause that was a special case. But with this one, it's in the Miko scene. We have a shot of Shibuya, which is actually page 5 of the preview. And we do like up close crowd scenes. And that gives us plenty of room to put the 10 people across a couple pages. So we already have those pages drawn, but I noted to Lom, like, hey, leave some room here because we're going to be putting Kickstarter backers in. So we put like generic, you know, fill-in models just to let me know what it would look like overall. So yeah, we're good on that.
Okay, that's great. I mean, I'm going to look forward to that because I always think it's a wonderful thing when people do. And the fact that it's sold out already, that is terrific.
Are you jealous, Wayne? Because if you want, I can add another reward to where you get drawn in.
I don't know if I can afford it right now. That's the only bad thing is, as much as I would love that, I'll keep an eye out for next time. But this time I'm gonna.
Well, it's funny you say the whole, you know, I can't afford it, is because you noted it early on the podcast that I had a rather reasonable goal of $750, and that's what I did for both 3 and 4 because of the pandemic. I know that people are struggling. I know that people are hurting. So I gave like this large swath of reward tiers with varying prices because I know that some people might only have $3 to pledge and some people might only have $5 to pledge. And I wanted to make sure that I, you know, was able to reach out to them as well as reaching out to people who can do the $50 or pledge $150 to get every comic I've ever made and so on and so forth. So it's fine, Wayne, to pledge what you can. Wow. And
I did.
I know.
That's the thing I want to point out is just because I didn't get to that, that doesn't mean I haven't pledged. I did pledge. There's a digital, I always say in here, and people are probably getting tired of me saying this, is that my physical space is becoming more and more limited. So my computer space is actually where I have room for some stuff. So I'm on the level that gets the whole Tokyo story so far, 1 through 4 in digital versions, which I really want to have. And that's, I'd like to have them all. I like things collected like that too. So it's going to be
wrong with that.
But you talked about in the video about the fact that now that these are done, you're actually going to do a collected edition.
Yes, we are going to, because we now have 4 issues, which I like to think of as a baseline for a trade paperback. That's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to compile it all together, 1 through 4, and then we're going to go put it up on Amazon, and we're going to start, you know, selling it there. And I'll use that. I'll use that volume version to start pitching to publishers, because I can say, hey, it's not just an idea, I've done 4 issues by myself. So, and then it's also easier to sell at Comic Cons, because now it's just like, oh, I have, here's issue 1. No, here's the first volume, and people really seem to resonate with that.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's going to be great. So again, this is it's going to conclude on Monday, December 7 at 6 p.m. If you go to Kickstarter, it's under Tokyo Blade Detectives number 4. And I think that's pretty easy to find. Yeah. So it shouldn't be a problem. You mentioned that there were other projects, a little downtime that you might be engaging in. Can you tell us any of the stuff about that? Or is that something we'd have to talk about another time?
No, I don't mind. I can go over quickly. Basically, I focused on Tokyo for the last year or so because this was a story that's been in my head for years. I wanted to finally tell it. With us now at the end of volume 1, I'm going to take a step back and I want to dive back into my Sherlock Holmes novel series, which I sent to you last Kickstarter, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I want to get back into that. There's a pure novel that I want to write that's my own original creation that I've been meaning to get to forever, but I just, things just keep devolving and I never get back to it. And then there's another comic I want to make called Take the House, which is a heist comic. And so that might be my big Kickstarter project for next year. But I want to take a break from Kickstarter because it's been so draining trying to get, you know, the funding and getting the comics made, getting the comics shipped. It's very taxing, as any Kickstarter person will tell you. And I've done 4 in basically a year, which is usually not recommended, but I knew I could get away with it because of my fan base. And I felt the comic would sell itself, and it did. But I want to take a break because, again, we're not out of this pandemic yet, and I want to write some stuff that is non-art related, like with the novels and everything. So just gonna take a small break, and then I'll get back to Tokyo one way or another.
Do you know when that's gonna take place? Or
I
roughly?
Honestly don't, because honestly, I wouldn't have predicted this year, as everyone would happily tell you. So, but I would like to say maybe late next year, depending on how things go.
Okay. Well, you know, the good news is you'll be back to it. And this is high quality stuff, so it's going to be worth the wait. So I think that'll be great. So again, it's Tokyo Blade Detectives number 4. And you get the Kickstarter. It, again, is going to conclude on Monday, December 7 at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Don't wait until then. Now is the time to get out there and do it. And when you get done listening to this episode, be sure to get out there and pledge. And we want to maybe if we get 200 or 300% of what you're asking for, maybe it might help with some future stuff. Who knows?
You never know.
You never know. Well, all I can say is keep it up. You're doing a great job as always, Todd. And I can't wait to see more Tokyo Blade Detective. I can't really wait to read number 4. It's going to be very...
I appreciate your support, Wayne. I really do.
Hey guys, this is Frank Ogle, writer of Dead End Kids and No Heroin. You recently heard me on the show to talk about my new book, Dead End Kids, The Suburban Job. Dead End Kids, The Suburban Job follows 3 former friends who have all been deeply affected by the events of September 11th as they struggle alone to cope with the long-term effects of that tragic day and what happens to them when they find a bag of cash stolen from a local drug kingpin. I just wanted to drop by and remind you guys that Dead End Kids Suburban Job is currently up for pre-order. For those of you who haven't checked out the original Dead End Kids, the Suburban Job is a fresh start, a new cast, and a new place with a new crime. For those of you who love the original series, we've got the entire creative team back together again to bring you more of what you loved the first time around. But whether you're a new or returning reader, I think you'll really dig the new series. If you want to check out Dead End Kids, The Suburban Job, be sure to get your pre-orders in at your local comic shop by December 4th.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Welcome to the Cthulhu Invades Oz Kickstarter. The Wizard of Oz is a timeless fantasy story known the world over with beloved characters that anyone could name. Lovecraft and, more importantly, Cthulhu have been in our nightmares for more than 100 years. Comic creators have been telling stories in both of these universes for years, but now it's time to put these two universes in a war.
It's always a pleasure to talk with Travis Gibb, the creator of such good things as Broke Down and Four Dead Bodies, Voodoo Nations, and who is the driving force behind an anthology series that's on Kickstarter right now, and I think I can actually pronounce it, Cthulhu Invades Oz. How you doing, Travis?
Good, good, good. Yep, you pronounced it right. Though I was just in an interview where they did not. They were Sakulu, like they kept saying it very weird.
So I hate to tell you, it took me years to figure that out. I just couldn't do it, and people would have to. I would say, now how do you pronounce that again? But I think finally, after I've been doing this podcast for years, and I think finally after all these years, I figured it out. So that's great.
Well, I think some would argue that it's wrong. I think I've heard some Lovecraft historians say that it's wrong, but like he's dead. And the majority of people who I know say Cthulhu. So let's just let them be right. Like it's public domain. We can claim it now, right?
That's right. It is what it is. And that's where it goes. Now, I'm always interested because it's so fascinating to me that Kickstarter is one of the places that anthologies seem to thrive. You know, DC and Marvel and all those people, they don't tend to do that. Although I noticed DC is doing more of it. They have these little summer, they did this weird one with computers and the beach. And I remember looking at it going, huh? But that one, they do those kinds of things, but it's really big on Kickstarter. And I think it's really cool that you're getting to do that. Why did you decide to do Cthulhu Invades Oz? What was it about it that attracted you to it?
Well, it was an idea that I came up with. My wife said, you know, what do you think would be a good thing that would do really well on Kickstarter? Because I was looking at Broke Down and Four Dead Bodies. And as you know, Wayne, crime is just not a big selling genre. Not on Kickstarter, not in Aftershock, not in Image, not in Vertigo. Like even the best crime book is still a low selling book. It's just the nature of it. And she said, what do you think would be a really good selling book that you could get behind? And I told her Cthulhu Invades Oz. I was like, Cthulhu does really well in most of the markets that I'm from. Oz does really well. Like, I think mixing those two genres would be really, really cool. And that's when I came up with the concept.
Now, as I understand it, you gather together a whole bunch of people. And, you know, I don't know whether I should name drop some of these that I've had on the podcast here. I've had Richard Rivera, David Byrne, Russell Nolte, Greg, and I'm sure I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, Elise.
Release. Yeah.
And Jonathan Hedrick, Brian, Brian Silverbacks from Loggerhead, Clara from Shadow Play, Joel Rodriguez, Rob Anderson, Caleb Palmquist, Matt Knowles and Steph Cannon, of course.
Yeah.
Gosh, there's a whole bunch of these people. The only one of those that I haven't talked to on the podcast was Clara. As an artist, I want to ask better questions to artists, but it's easier to talk to a writer because a writer is used to dealing in words. So I tend not to, I've done, I think, good jobs with them. But anyway, you've got this really nice group of people who are doing this stuff. And of course, there's a whole bunch of people on there I don't happen to know. Just because I don't happen to know them doesn't mean they're not good. They are. And there's just a lot of talent involved. This is 140 pages, right?
Yeah. It's it'll probably clock in about we're doing the final draft right now. I think the one I sent you was like 147, and we're at like 155 now. So it'll probably be at 160 or so when it's all said and done.
Wow. That's a book.
Yeah.
That's a book. So I'm just fascinated because, you know, the mixing of genres, it appeals to people because it's something we haven't seen before. So I think you've done a really good job of collecting a really good group of people. And as I read the book and I looked it over a little bit, I was really intrigued that it seems that this is sequential, that the story is moving forward, which most anthologies are sort of, well, here's this and this happened 2 weeks ago and this is next week. But this one is actually, you've actually got a sequential story going on.
Yeah, that was the kind of the idea. So when I put it together, there's a few rules. And one was whatever, if you have a character, that character is yours. Two, everything is a snippet of what's happening. So these are days of the invasion. So things happen at different days. So, you know, we had the beginning and the end kind of laid out. And then we knew in the beginning, in the middle, we wanted kind of the war for Emerald City and what that looks like. So, yeah, when we put it all together, it had that flow. And one of the things that was really cool about it, as someone who's read it, what we learned is the people who did the stories in the beginning, they were very dark. And then they got lighter towards the end. So it really felt, and what I loved about it, really felt like Oz, you know, was kind of affecting Cthulhu as he was invading, causing all this horror around. It's also affecting him. And he gets a little bit more silly as it goes, too. So the Oz magic works both ways, which I thought was really cool.
That's fascinating because it's such an interesting thing to see Cthulhu influenced. I mean, he's usually doing the influencing.
Right.
So that's really something. Now, one of the things in the book that I was really fascinated by is the prose pages. There's a Cthulhu invasion day, and then has the day. And then there is looks like almost like a poem in places. Did you write those, or those the creators write those?
So those are written by David Greschel. He wrote all the poems in there. There's a couple of pages that, again, you've got a work copy, so we're going to add some actual prose in there that kind of explain the narratives a little bit. You know, one of them being, you know, explaining as you've read it. You know, some of these depictions of these characters are really going to be shocking to people. So we want to kind of warn people that this is different phases of a war, and war changes people. That's what wars do. But yeah, so we had a poet come in to kind of bring that Lovecraft feel to the book, because Lovecraft is very poetic when he writes. You know, look at Cats of Uthar. You know, it's a very poetic story.
Yeah, I think he would really be – I think he'd be proud of the stuff that you put together because it's really different. I mean, in all my experience of reading comics and related stuff, I haven't read anything like this. And it's just, you know, if somebody is on the fence about supporting it, I say dive in, because there is some stuff in here that you have never seen before. And that is really great stuff. So I think that's a credit to you as kind of being the coordinator, as well as getting the creators to come up with this amazing stuff and different styles too. That's one of the things I really like. So one of them in particular is in black and white.
Yeah.
And you've got other ones that are, you know, very different. I don't want to, in some ways it's a nice surprise to see. There's like a painted feel one. There is one of them that's sort of sepia toned.
And the stained glass one that's in there was by Rob Anderson. Yeah.
Just amazing, amazing stuff. I love the creativity and the variety of it. Well, actually, there's two black and white. Now, I forgot about this story right here that I'm looking at. Treatise of Terror, that's black. Well, that's the same story, and that's part two. Yeah, that's why it's black and white. Okay, I got you. But see, that brings another point that I was kind of curious about. You had some stories broken into different parts. And I found that interesting, too, because, you know, again, this is unusual for anthologies. And to see a story like that that you really got to pay attention to, I liked that. I found that to be really engaging as I was reading through it. I really thought, wow, this is really a creative process. I really like it.
Yeah, that was one of the cool things that we came up with is when we were looking at that. So that story is a scarecrow, you know. And there's a certain amount of time where he does some research, and we needed time for that. So the greatest thing about these having days of invasions, we can add that time in to show that, hey, during this time, you know, he was somewhere else doing research, which I found really cool. And again, that's the power of having a narrative, and that's the power of having a prose. You know, one of the things I did differently of this anthology versus the other anthologies you see on Kickstarter is I handpicked everybody. Not necessarily the creative teams, but I handpicked a core member of the team, whether it be the artist or the writer, who was like, hey, I know you that you know how to do these things, and I want to put you part of it. And I think that that helped a lot because it showed everyone in the room had something to bring. They may not, like you said, know everybody, you know, but they all were A-games. A lot of these guys are Scout or Mad Cave or Source Point Press or Action Labs. Some Image and Aftershock guys are even in there. So it allowed a lot of pros to really get to play in a very cool environment because, let's be honest, Wayne, a lot of us want to be the Marvel and DC guys, right? That's what we want to get to. Odds are we're not going to get there. Probably out of this 52 creators, one of us is ever going to even have a shot to even do it. This gives us an idea to work with an IP that we love and care about, just like a Spider-Man or a Batman or a Superman.
Well, one of the things I enjoyed too about the book is that you have a hardcover edition, an Orange Cone exclusive softcover, and a direct market softcover, which I like. Those are, I mean, really good books I like to get in hardcover. Although, unfortunately, as I keep saying, I'm running out of physical space. So when I pledged on this, I went for the digital invasion and audio commentary. Audio commentary, that's another thing I want to ask about. Who you're obviously going to be involved with the audio commentary. Who else is going to be providing audio commentary for this book?
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the team and get as many of them as I can together to talk about it. And I'm going to have them do commentary if they're available on their own story. So, you know, if Chuck's there, I'll have Chuck Pino do it and have commentary on their story as we go through it. So we'll go page by page, and we're leaving little Easter eggs in throughout the book to kind of talk about the history of putting together the team, why we picked that team, why they got certain stuff. So we're going to ask everybody, and whoever comes to that is going to come to do that, you know. And that's what makes us really unique in this anthology is all these people really want to share their stories. You know, we've been doing a lot of podcasts and a lot of shows, and it's not just me. Like right now, you and I are talking. I have Eric Hawkins, who did the Toto story. He's on a show called Indie Vault right now, promoting Cthulhu Invades Oz, trying to get us backers and encourage it, because it's a big number for us. Most of us are like low-level Kickstarter guys, so we're 3,000 to 5,000 level, you know. So 20,000 is a big jump for us. So getting to that is hard. It's a lot of work.
Well, you know, people always chastise me for not giving the vital info early enough, so I'm going to jump to that. This project will only be funded, it says, if it reaches its goal by Tuesday, November 24, which isn't far away, at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Time. So as I always say to people, don't wait. This is not the time to sit back and say, well, I got time. The time is now to get out there and support it. The goal is $20,000. And as we're talking, and we're talking a little ahead of time, of course, you're actually pretty far along towards that. And this might date us, but you've got 421 backers already, which is a good number to have. I think that, you know, you should be congratulated for that. That you're off to a great start.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things I want to point out too, you know, why you shouldn't wait on this. A lot of these books can be picked up by Scout or some of these other things. This book doesn't have a real ability to do that because there's so many other people's stories involved, right? There's a lot of contracts that would have to be signed to make that happen. So the odds of it getting in stores, unless there's a retailer who bought packages, which they have, we've had six retailers who bought packages, your ability to get this is very, very low if you don't get it on the Kickstarter.
Of course, if conventions rise up and you might be able to.
Right. Yeah. Our guys will be able to buy comps and we'll have stuff at shows. Sure. But again, you know, there's out of all the people who go to shows, there's a lot of people who don't.
That's so true. You've got now each 50 backers, Mark, unlocks one free digital comic, and you've got some really interesting ones in there too. I want to get back to the book in just a minute, but I'm fascinated because, you know, Blake Undying, which is one I really like. other ones. I think Ruby from Planet Oz. That's another Oz book.
Yeah. It's a Oz, like a kind of sci-fi Oz book. Yep.
That's if we get your fussy 400 backers. I think that's already there.
Yeah, that's unlocked. In fact, we announced it in the update. Now that we've hit 400, it's every 25. So literally in 4 more backers, I'm going to give another digital comic out. So for $1, right now, you're getting 8 books.
Wow.
Which is really cool.
If I can push also for Capable, Jonathan Hedrick's book, which I really like. And there's a lot of really interesting books that you've got to go in there. See, the thing I think that's so great is that you have this great network of people that you work with, and you're able to bring all those people to help make this, you know, a memorable creation, and also to make it that's something that people will want to get, that's unique as far as people. I think, you know, that's a great thing that you're doing, Travis. I love the way that you do that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we've been working really hard at it, but yeah, it's been a killer, you know, putting this together, and the support from the community has been really, really good. Like right now, I'm running a competition with another Kickstarter called Wailing Blades. Wailing Blades is published through Diamonds, through Comics Tribe. He does really, really good. And we're on par with him for backers. We're actually doing a race to 450 because he's at like 416. I was at 417 when we started the race. I think I'm winning right now. Let's check. So I'm at 421. Let's see where he's at. But it's cool because this guy's Tyler James. He's an amazing guy. Teaches people how to do this. And I'm beating him in backers, which is just crazy to even think of. Like, never in my wildest dreams. Because this guy's a master at these things. He's got 416 right now.
416. Well, you're ahead of him. That's good.
I'm ahead of him. Yeah, I'm winning.
Let's keep that going. I think that's a great thing to accomplish, to do this kind of thing.
And it's just fun. I love their book. I back their book. You know, I support it. I support everything they do. It's just fun to have these little competitions with these people who are your equals and rivals in the Kickstarter space.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing that you've got, I think that people should know about, is that you've got this holiday gift bundle.
Yeah.
Which is just the perfect timing for that. You know, you pick a soft cover and you send it to a friend or family with that. And that's a great way to do it. That's a perfect thing. Now, this is going to the only question I have for you is this going to make it for this holiday, hopefully?
So we're hoping to, but we're a little nervous. So we put February as the release date.
Okay.
But what we did instead, so if you buy it for somebody, the digital will be out by Christmas.
Oh, good. Okay. So you get something good. That's good.
Yeah. So you'll get a Christmas card that's sent to them that says, hey, you're getting this. Here's the digital. Your physical will come soon after that. So we made a Christmas card. It's a spinoff of The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. So it's Cthulhu with a sleigh driving down the yellow brick road with Toto on his head. It's a beautiful little card that we're going to send to that family member or friend who you'd like to give it to, so we can let them know that, hey, it's going to arrive.
Mm-hmm. Super cool. Well, that's great. I think that's going to be great. And they're going to make sure it arrives before December 24th. That's a great thing, particularly now. And you have a picture of the card that says, there's no place like home for the horror days.
Right.
I like that. That's kind of cool. And you get five tags with it too.
Yeah, you get 5 little Christmas tags with it. And we've had people buy that bundle. They're like, I don't want to give this to a family member. I just want that card. And I'm like, yeah, man, do it.
That's when you know you've hit. Not only do you want to give it to somebody, you actually want it for yourself. That's right.
The other one I want to show you, did you see the Bloody Brick Road above that? That's one of our favorite attractions.
I'm on the page right now. Let me get to it.
Yeah, it's a little bit above what you just talked about.
Yeah, let me get to that. It's going to take a second here. Where is it? I'll edit this part out. Bloody Brick Road, come on.
It's right under those milestone rewards.
Yeah, I've managed to. Oh shoot!
Well, why don't you find it and I'll talk about it while you're looking for it. How's that?
Go ahead. Let's go.
Sure. So the Bloody Brick Road, what it is? So you get a sign, the orange cone, the exclusive one for the Kickstarter, the exclusive cover, plus all the digital stuff. That sign coming. Comes signed, so we're going to have some at least 5 of the guys sign it, and it also comes with three mystery first issues in the back. Mm-hmm. So we're going to give some of the creators or have donated issues that we're going to put in the bag signed, which is really, really cool. So we're going to send indie comics to people from all around. And, I saw you this weekend. I bought some of Richard Rivera's stuff and had him sign them just for this bundle, which is really, really cool. People really love it. And the price is right. $47, you know, if you're buying Kickstarter, you're buying $20 a book. So that's $60 plus a trade, which is $30. I mean, you're at like $100-something value.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's great. And I like the way that you put all these things together. And I think it just makes it so appealing. I mean, you understand what people are looking for and you appeal to that. And I think that's a great way to do that. Just great stuff. So, well, why don't we start talking about the book itself? You've got actually the first story is yours, and it's called The Sellout.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I don't want to spoil, but it's got a really good ending at it.
Well, yeah, I think that's the one book you can spoil, right? Because it kind of sets up everything, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the premise is Dorothy gets meet up with not just Cthulhu creatures. So in this book, it's not just Cthulhu. There's actually a lot of the creatures from the Lovecraft mythos. So she meets a few of them. She meets, the Deep Ones, the Melagoths, and I can't remember the last one off the top of my head, but she meets a couple of these creatures. And the difference between Dorothy meeting them and like a normal person is she treats them like she'd treat a character from Oz. You know, she talks to them and treats them with kindness and respect, and they share stories and talk. And basically, you know, that gets Dorothy in trouble because these creatures aren't like the ones from Oz.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And let's just say bad things happen.
And, because of that, because of what happens in that story, Cthulhu can invade the wonderful Wizard of Oz, the wonderful times of Oz.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm slow. I just got to the Bloody Brick Road. And why don't you talk a little bit more about that? We'll go back there for a second.
Yeah. So like I said, it's you get the digital copy. So let me tell you what's special about the Kickstarter edition. So the Kickstarter edition, it's going to be UV rays. So you're going to be able to touch that book and feel it. And it's going to have like cool effects on it. That's exclusively to the Kickstarter. Or a creator at a con. So a creator at a con can sell it to you. But if you don't get it at those two places, you know, you're not going to be able to get it. Mm-hmm. The Bag of Cthulhu is three mystery first issues. So what that is any of the 50 plus creators have donated some issues to me, and I'm going to give three of those per bag. So, mm-hmm. And they're signed and autographed by the creator. So you could get Richard Stabbity Bunny. You could get Matt Knowles, Herald of Isildur. You could get Chucks Bial. You get My Voodoo Nations or Broke Down in Four Dead Bodies. You could get The Pit, which is Ryan Samecki's book. You could get The Recount from Jonathan Hendrick. You could get Savage Bastards from Mad Cave, et cetera, et cetera. And then one out of every 10 will be a sketch cover by an artist. So I'll have some of the artists do some sketch covers that'll also be mixed in there as well.
Wow. There's lots of good stuff with that. That's another great idea to be able to get people to support it. I think that's really great the way that you're making these things happen.
Yeah. Right. It's not just to support, it's to show the other works of these amazing creators, right?
That's great. And of course, that really helps as far as those good things too, because every creator is happy to get a little more exposure. You never know. You might get a couple more sales out of it. People see the book, say, oh my gosh, I got to follow this series. Yeah. So that's a great way to do that. Wonderful stuff. So some of the names of these stories get me.
Yeah.
the one I particularly like is called, it says how to, let me make sure I get it right. How to responsibly own a dog in the land of Oz. That's an interesting one.
Yeah, that was that one we don't want to spoil the ending, but that was an interesting ending and an interesting telling of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting about Toto, if you don't know, so there's 14 books in the Oz series. And as the Oz books progress, she doesn't just hang out with Toto anymore. She hangs out with a chicken called Belinda as well.
Yeah.
For anybody who's watched Return to Oz, you've seen that. But one of the things that happens in Oz is all characters can talk. Mm-hmm. So in one of the books, Toto talks in one of the books, and they ask Toto, hey, if you can talk, why have you never talked to me? And Toto says, you've never asked me a question. Bye. Walks away.
That's really cool. Well, you mentioned the chicken, and we have to go back. A little before that one is the chicken one. That's one of the black and white stories. And let's just say that the chicken's in trouble.
Yeah, from the Wheelers, which are a really cool little group that are from Return to Oz.
Mm-hmm. And they say one of the great mistakes. Thanks. Any last words, chicken? Don't ever ask somebody that.
Right.
That's always a big mistake. And they come to regret that, shall we say.
They do.
It's a great, great.
And I love that art. That art is so fun. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk to you about the Jack Pumpkinhead one.
Yeah. Brian Silverback and David Burns.
Yeah, the There Goes the Neighborhood, it's called. And one of the things I enjoy so much about it is that Jack is, shall we say, changing heads on occasion.
Yes.
Which I got a kick out of. You know, that was a very funny thing is he's making other heads that he can wear and stuff. And again, bad things happen.
It's such a beautiful story. Brian Silverback did a fantastic job. I mean, and it's a big chunk of change. One of the things that's interesting about this anthology versus others, some people have 10, 12 page stories in it. You know, they're not all like four quick ones. You know, they're sometimes, you know, half a comic book.
How did you decide how to do that? I mean, did people propose that they wanted to do a certain number of pages? How did this work? How did you make that happen?
Yeah. So I said the maximum was 12 pages. So the maximum was 12 pages, you know, so half an issue. And then I allowed slots of it. So I would allow four 12 page stories, four 10 page stories, six 8 page stories, seven 1 page. So I basically had numbers that kind of said how many I'd accept of anything.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's just amazing stuff. So it's really great. So one of the other stories that I liked was called Oz Unraveling.
Yes, that is. Don't tell anybody because I'll deny it. That is my personal favorite.
Really? Okay, because that's actually got the story and art by the same person, which I liked. I argue with some people whether, you know, are artists good writers, and they're not always. This is a really wow.
that's Glenda. So that's Jamie Primack. She is fantastic. She is out of Chicago. And what's interesting about it is she normally only works in black and white. Mm-hmm. And there's some black and white pages in there, but she normally only works in black and white. And working in color, I mean, man, it's a shame she doesn't work in color all the time. This is all hand painted. Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful art. It's just gorgeous.
It's a shocking story. Shall we say? More than that, I want to say. The next one is a favorite of mine. Of course, Richard Rivera wrote it. It's 1001, and there's a reason for that title. And it has to do with the Cowardly Lion.
Yeah.
Of course, Clara Meath was the artist who worked with him on Shadow Play. So this was kind of a reteaming of that group. And it's a really interesting story. It's, you know, the business about war and everything. It comes to play really good. That's a great story. You see, my problem is I want to spoil stuff and I just don't dare because it would ruin the story for people. And I want people to get as much enjoyment out of it as I did. So
what's really good is Richard Rivera. What's great about his writing style is he wanted to make sure it's right. So before he even gave me a script, he's like, I want to make sure I understand the lion. And he did some research about Lion's territory in Oz, you know, mm-hmm. when Lion became no longer the Cowardly Lion, you know, he came and took over a territory. And this is, you know, basically Cthulhu coming to that territory and what that looks like and mm-hmm. who the Cowardly is and how he's grown as a character is really showcased in this story. But you've got some beautiful, tender moments mm-hmm. and a great butt. Clara gave Lion some great butt there.
Okay. We'll have to make sure Clara knows that, though.
Yeah, Clara knows. She gave the butt nudity in our book quota.
Okay. Well, it's a lion. See, that's okay.
It's a lion butt, so it's fine. It has a tail to block anything.
Yeah. So now we've got a Jonathan Hedrick story, The Heart of Rust, which, of course, is the Tin Man.
Yeah.
I was touched by that. This is the one that's kind of in sepia tone. as far as the coloring goes.
Yeah, it's they did that to show like that because they're out at sea. They kind of showed it like in this weird like effect to it. So it's not black and white. It's in this kind of weird tone to it. And it's just a beautiful piece. You know, the Tin Man comes, you know, against Cthulhu in a scene, and it is such a beautiful image.
It's wild. You know, it's hard when you're describing something on an audio podcast. I always feel badly because here I am trying to convey what something looks like in words, and I don't always live up to that challenge. But let me say, the end, the last panel got me.
Yeah.
Shall I say? I really like that. But all these stories are kind of like that.
I honestly, you know, I've read all of Jonathan's work to date. Recount is definitely number one. So if you're, I'm not sure when you're hearing this, but try to get it. But this is, in my opinion, is the second best thing he's ever written. Like more than Capable, more than the, you know, the Freak Show stuff. This story has heart and soul and depth. It's really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Now then one after that is interesting. It doesn't start out with the title right away, but I'm trying to remember the name of the character as I'm looking at the guy with the kind of the it almost looks like a crown. This is the Munchkins, isn't it?
The crown, is it the white guy with the crown?
Yeah. Well,
That's a bad guy. That's called the man in yellow, and it's the Emerald City Guard. That's the Emerald City Guard. That's a Cthulhu villain.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, I didn't put that together. So that's interesting.
Yeah, see, I think that's a deep cut. If you know about Cthulhu, you'll know that symbol. You'll know that picture. It's a new design for him, but yeah.
Just wild stuff. There's so many. Then there's a story of the last guards of the Emerald City that I liked.
Right.
That one's really good too. That's story and art by Tyler Carpenter.
Tyler Carpenter. Well, maybe we are talking about a different story. Sorry, I'm looking at the Kickstarters. The one before?
Last Guards of Emerald City, story, art, and colors by Tyler Carpenter.
Right, but what's the one before? Because I thought we must have
missed. Did I pass one? I probably passed one when I'm in the process. Oh, that was the Treatise of Terror Part 2. That one is the black and white one. That's Chuck Panow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one too. I thought I would recognize that as the second part, but there's all kinds of good stories.
You think you know where that one's going to go when you know the second part. You're like, oh, I know where this is going to go. And it does not go where you think it's going to go.
See, I love that kind of writing. I really do. And then there's the Chess Match of Oz by the guy who does the Werespider.
Yeah, that is a beautiful piece.
Oh, my gosh. That is stunning. No, he doesn't do the art, but Greg is great on writing those kinds of stories. And the art matches the story. You've got all kinds of creatures and monsters and stuff like that going at it.
It shows that what's beautiful about The Wizard of Oz as a whole is it can fit in any genre. So that story particularly, you know, shows that a Game of Thrones type story can fit in Oz. And that's why there's been so many adaptations from sci-fi shows to, you know, The Wonderful Wizard of, you know, that's what's beautiful about, you know, The Wizard of Oz as a whole is it can fit in all these different genres.
It's amazing. And, you know, I probably shouldn't talk about each and every one, but there's the Charge of the Lollipop Guild.
Yeah.
That's a good one. That one is written by Kurt Belcher and Michael Spivey. And the art is good by Michael Barker, I think, Mikkel. I'm probably fracturing that person's name.
Yeah, that's a beautiful little piece. You know, I love that picture in the window when the Cthulhu's invading the Munchkin City. It's really, really good. And we tried to get all these different characters of Oz, all these different, you know, side characters.
It's so weird to see Cthulhu there. That's the thing. In every story, it still makes me – I still get a shock when I see Cthulhu in there. it's just well done. And then, of course, there's the Yellow Brick Road and the Warlock of the South, which is – we talked about this painting or this the stained glass look to it.
Right, really, and that's Martha. You know Martha from some of the cons, right? She does the anime stuff. This is very, very different style for her.
Yeah, gosh, it's ends very shockingly, shall we say. That one, of course, is written by Rob, and just great stuff. Gosh, I've got to really talk though about the one about the Wicked Witch of the West.
Yeah.
That is a shocker. That Russell Nolte, of course, who's great at these kinds of stories, goes someplace I didn't expect, shall I say.
Yeah, what was beautiful about that piece is, so I had separated all the people and set it up, the whole story and the ending and all that stuff. And Russell was like, hey, can I have Glinda? I was like, no, Jamie's going to do Glinda. And he's like, oh, okay. He's like, can I get the Wicked Witch of the West? Probably someone's taking her. I was like, no. And he's like, no. And I did it. He wrote this story, and he wrote it for me relatively fast. And I read it, and I was like, that's the ending. That's the perfect ending to this story. So he wrote the ending. That's the final piece. There is an epilogue, that's the final, big piece of, novels.
And then, of course, the epilogue is written by Joel Rodriguez.
Yes.
He does a lot of good stuff. And his surprised me. I let's just say it goes a direction I didn't expect, shall we say.
Yeah. But it played at Joel's strength, right? So Joel's really good at comedy and horror mixed in. And he did a really good job. You know, the Dust County Chronicles are known for their comedy as well as their horror. Mm-hmm. And putting that both together was a treat.
Yeah, when you get to the end, I was surprised, shall we say. The end, you get to, there's a book, blue book, that has the words "the end" on it, and you get to see what's going to take place next. Which leads me to a question.
Uh-huh.
Let's say this is successful, and I'm certain it will be. Is there any chance that, given the little tease at the end of the book, that you might do another one of these kinds of things, but going where the story would naturally go after the last page?
Correct. Yep. We announced, so it's official. You don't have to hide it. It does
spoil the
ending a little bit, but we think a lot of people don't listen to these podcasts. You know, not, we think a lot of people do. It's not an offensive thing. Like, the hardcore fans do, but the average reader doesn't, right? Does that make sense?
Yep.
So we're okay with the people who listen to this want to be spoiled. They want to know everything about this as fast as possible. So we agreed if we got to halfway funded in the first week that we would announce it. So we did announce it. The sequel is Cthulhu Invades Wonderland, and that is in production, assuming this gets funded. So the only thing that holds in its way now is if this gets funded, we will green light it and I'll hand pick and we will start production of that. But what's cool about that, Wayne, is everything that happens in this book is continuity for that book.
Hmm. So it'll continue on. I mean, are you likely to have some of the same creators pick up stories?
Yeah. I'll probably take away half the team, and not because they did a bad job, but just to have room for new creators. Mm-hmm. So we'll probably cut the team in half. And I'm not sure how I'll figure that out, but I'll cut the team in half and then I'll add a whole bunch of new creators in here and then we'll start the sequel to this. But there's also talks. One of the cool things, the way we did things, and we had different days of the invasion, is there's nothing preventing us from going back and doing a sequel to the original from Cthulhu Invades Oz, because again, these things happen at very time. You know, when you hit Scarecrow, he is in a very dark space. I'd love to see some of the earlier stories of Scarecrow before he got in that dark place and how it happened. You know, so, the same thing with Lion, you know. Lion has a big epic scene at the end of his thing. What happens after that? Let's see what happens, you know.
So Oz fights back?
Yeah. Actually, what I'd probably call it, if there was a sequel, would probably be the Return to the Bloody Brick Road, I think was what I'd call it.
Okay, that's good.
I really like that Bloody Brick Road. Like, I came up with that after the first week of this being in production, even though this has been with me for a year, this has been in production for a year and a half. I finally came up with a good tagline, and it was once we already had all the marketing material made.
Cool. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. You've only got a couple days, so don't wait. This is the time to jump on board. If he hasn't gotten the goal already, make sure he does. and get to that, once you get past that $20,000, that will be maybe some, might be enough time to stick a stretch goal or two in there, which would be fun.
Yeah, that would be really good. We also have a really cool stretch goal that you probably missed, and not stretch goal, but a high tier at the end. We just announced this on Monday, which is pretty cool. Actually, we have two things that aren't on the Kickstarter page that I think you'd really like. Do you know David Pepos?
Yes, I do.
David Pepos is going to do the Ford for this.
Really?
He's agreed to do the Ford. And if you don't know, last month he did a Kickstarter called the OZ, which is an Oz-related one.
He yes,
made
he
almost $50,000 on it.
Yes, he did.
And 1,500 backers. It killed. Which is insane.
First and it was his first one. That's right, the first one.
Yeah, so he's going to do the Ford in this. And then the new pledge goal that we have at the end, Wayne, which is really cool, is it's $1,000. And what we'll do is we will write a four-page backup for someone's story. Meaning you'll be able to pick a writer between myself, Jonathan Hendricks, David Galliano, Stoney Williams, Chuck Pino. You'll be able to pick an artist. We have a couple of artists who volunteered at the time, Michael Watson, Emily Rissett, and James Burton. Pick a colorist, pick a letterer, pick an editor, and we'll put together a four-page story for whatever your comic is. And as someone who created comics or knows a lot of creators, that's a bargain for those names.
Mm-hmm. Great, great. Wow, that you got a lot of good things cooking. That's going to be great stuff. So, again, I want to point out, it's Tuesday, November the 24th, 11:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Don't wait until that time. Get on board right now is the thing to do. Well, now while I'm talking to you, why don't I get an update on your other projects? Like, I just got Voodoo Nations, I think, and I unfortunately haven't read it. I just got it this weekend, and it's packed in our stuff that we got from Kingdom of Comics. But what about Broke Down and Four Dead Bodies? How's that doing?
Yeah, so it's done. I'm at like three pages away from being done. Not 100%. It's three pages away from being completely done. We'd be normally kickstarting about this time, but Cthulhu had to come first just because of all the creators and all the time. As you know, one of the great things about me on Kickstarter versus other people, and not that anybody's bad, just I don't go to Kickstarter unless it's like 95% done. So meaning the book will be finished before the end of the Kickstarter. So yeah, we're going to wrap up issue 4, you know, wrap up that first story arc, get that all done. So it'll all be wrapped up in a nice little package and really tell that ending to that beautiful tale, you know.
Be sure to tell other people that, because there's a lot of people on Kickstarter who don't believe in that. And there's some Kickstarters I have supported. I have yet to get any of the stuff.
Yeah, I have a friend of mine who does it, even though I've told him over and over again, he literally will produce another Kickstarter before he's even sent out the package from the one before. And every time he gets lower numbers and he complains, and I'm like, because you got to send your stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You know, especially too, one of the reason why, you know, I have 6 retail packages sold right now, that's higher than the average Kickstarter. So an average Kickstarter, I'll have 1 or 2 sold. The reason why is retailers trust and know that I'm going to get it to them relatively fast because they don't want their money on hold. That money could be used on Diamond to buy stuff that they could flip very easily. So to do that, to get into Diamond, to get in these stores, you got to do that. So yeah, Broke Down 4 will finish up that storyline, which is really, really good. I'm really excited for that. It's a long time coming. So that'll wrap all that up and, you know, we'll put a bow on it. We'll then probably let it sit for a year and then we'll come up with a trade with some extra content and stuff.
Mm-hmm. There are other projects. These are probably keeping you busy, but there are other things going on that we should know about.
Yeah. So Voodoo Nations 2 will also be coming out at the beginning of the year. So that's a new – that's the second part of that. That did really well. Voodoo Nations did better than some of my Broke Down books. That's about 2 missionaries. We never talked about it on the show. It's about 2 missionaries. Go to Brazil. They meet a voodoo priest. That voodoo priest messes up their world, and it brings them all over the world, from New Orleans to Mexico, to try to cure what affects him. So it's a wild ride, world trekking, and it's a lot of fun. We kind of learn what happens when voodoo priests talk to each other, when they're organized, like a Christian faith.
Right.
Yeah, and then I've got 2 books that are coming out at the beginning of the year as well from other publishers. So I've got one – called it's about, I'm struggling with the name right now. A final, Sacrificial Lamb. There you go. Sorry. And it's a vampire story I wrote at the beginning of the COVID. Mm-hmm. So it's a gentleman's writing it. It's, as far as I know, it's the first vampire story that happens in COVID. So it's basically all these vampires who've had to deal with the shutdowns and not be able to regularly feed. And they go hunting and how they go about doing that. So that's with a guy named Alfie. He wrote that and he hired me as a writer to do that. I've got another book called Extinct that is coming out, which is really, really cool. It's about this world where everything you do costs you your breath. So you only get so many breaths. It's a whole bunch of islands that are separated. And because of the islands, there's no oxygen. There's a lack of oxygen because oxygen primarily comes from trees. Though water does produce oxygen, there is somebody keeping that oxygen. That's part of the story. So every time you do anything, it costs you your life, and kind of showing that world and what that sci-fi world would be like.
Wow. Good stuff. Now, as I sometimes forget, but even though we've talked before, if people want to follow you, how do they do that on social media?
Yeah, so they can follow me at Jester Lou, JesterLou. That's on Twitter, on Instagram. My Facebook is just Travis Gibb. You can follow, Travis Gibb comic writer. Or you can follow me personally. Mm-hmm. And then all of our different properties have their own Facebook pages. So, Cthulhu Invades Oz, Broke Down in Four Dead Bodies, Voodoo Nations, they all have their own little network. So you can kind of check them out yourself. And they all have their own website, voodoonations.com, Broke Down in Four Dead Bodies.com, and CthulhuInvades.com.
That's a smart way to do things, I have to say. So you're doing all the good things here, and I am expecting that Cthulhu Invades Oz will be a big success. We'll blow past that 20,000, and everybody will get all the good stuff. Hopefully the holiday stuff will be on time. That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to see the next one. We'll have to talk again when the next one comes around, because it's always fun to talk with you, and there's always so much going on that we should be talking.
Yeah, I would love to talk to you, definitely when we do Broke Down, because you had so many great questions during the first interview that we did about Broke Down. I think we did it on issue 2.
Yeah, I think it was.
So I think that getting there and, re-listening to that and then having conversations, because you had a whole bunch of theories and we talked about some of those theories. I'd love to investigate that a little bit.
Yeah, we'll have to see how this all turns out, whether I was actually right or I was way off the mark, which I often am. So it's worth it to find out what's going on for those. And maybe if I get to talk with you, you'll send me a promo copy that I could look at and read the story. That would be great, too. I'd like to see how this goes. Anyway, enough of that stuff. Enough of trying to beg for something. Travis, just keep up the good stuff. I know this is going to be a success. I think good success is going to continue for you as we get into 2021. So all I can say is you're doing the right stuff. Just keep doing it. And we're here waiting for it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Until next time, keep reading your comics.